They went to Randy's door, five of them, led by Allport, followed by the Hammer, then Dell, then Lucas, with Marshall trailing. At the door, Allport spoke into a handset. Ready? The uniforms in back were in position, and Allport slipped his gun and pushed the doorbell. No answer. He pushed it again, and they heard feet on the stairs. And then a bolt rattled, and the door opened a crack. Through the crack, Lucas saw a slice of Randy's face. Randy jerked back and screamed, "Shit!" as the door slammed and the bolt slammed with it, and Allport said, "Hit it!" The uniform swung his sledgehammer at the doorknob. The door blew open. Allport did a quick peek, turning for the stairs, Dell two steps behind him, when the first gun banged overhead, and Allport screamed, "Gun!" and he and Dell both scrambled out the door. Lucas did a quick peek, saw nothing, and heard Allport screaming, "Gun!" into his handset. And then he was onto the stairs, moving up, felt Dell behind him as a shadow, and they both watched the railing at the top of the stairwell. From up the stairs, Lucas heard glass break, then another shot bang through the apartment, and he looked back, and it wasn't Dell behind him, but Marshall, a trooper's long-barreled .357 revolver in his fist. He had no time to think when Marshall said, "I'll go to the top, you peek over the rail," and then Marshall was past him. Marshall scrambled out onto the carpet at the top, and he was shouting, "Living room is clear, I don't see him." Another bang from the back, and Lucas shouted, "He's in the back, it sounds like he went out." He heard somebody screaming, watch it, coming your way, watch it." Allport, he thought, and then he was at the top of the stairs and saw Marshall, headed toward a hallway leading toward the back. Lucas heard more shouting from the back and ran down the hallway just in time to hear a fusillade of shots. He was coming up on a room to his right and a closed door on his left. He did a quick peek into the bedroom, saw nothing, continued through a small kitchen, got to the window and looked out. Randy Whitcomb was lying face up, spread-eagled on the grass below the back deck. His shirt was soaked with blood. Lucas turned, saw Dell and Marshall in the hallway and said, "He's down out back, check the rooms." Allport and the Hammer cop loomed from the living room. To Allport, Lucas said, "Get an ambulance." Then he was out and down the stairs onto the lawn, where the St. Paul uniforms, guns still drawn, had gathered around Randy. Randy had been hit four times, twice in the legs, once in the stomach, and once in his left forearm. Randy wasn't saying anything. Not a sound. No whimpers. Nothing. "Got an ambulance coming," Lucas said to him. He didn't hear it. One of the St. Paul uniforms said, "He had a gun." "Yeah, he let go a couple of times inside," Lucas said. One of the other cops said, "I think it's in the bushes. He had it in his hand when he came out." "Find it," Lucas said. "Don't touch. Just find it." Dell came out on the deck. "Nobody in the house, but, there's a lot of blood up here." "Nobody shot at him up there?" No, I mean, somebody else's blood. He was trying to clean it up with paper towels, but it's kind of splattered on the couch." Now Randy moaned, just once. Lucas looked down at him. "What'd you do?" But Randy didn't hear him. From the corner of the house, one of the St. Paul uniforms said to Lucas, "Got the gun, Chief. Just stay right next to it until the crime scene people get here." Allport came out on the deck and asked, "Everybody okay?" "Everybody except Randy. He's hit pretty hard." Lucas looked down at him again. Even with the convulsions running through his upper body, his lower body never moved. "Spinal," he thought. "What the fuck did you do, you little asshole? What'd you do?" Lucas, Dell, and Marshall clustered around the bottom of the apartment steps. Marshall said, "Why'd he open up? Because we took the door down?" "It's that blood," Dell said. "Something happened up there." "He couldn't be our guy," Marshall said. "You didn't have any goddamn 12 or 13-year-old traveling around the countryside picking up women in their 20s. "He was probably just a connection," Lucas said. "But he knows our guy." "We could get a name tonight, then," Marshall said. "They sew him up." "If he'll talk," Dell said. "He's a little asshole, and he'll be pissed." "More pissed than you might think," Lucas said. "His legs aren't moving. The slug that took him in the stomach might have clipped his spine. Marshall winced, and Dell said, "Ah, shit." The crime scene people were taping the apartment when the three of them climbed back up after Randy was taken away. Allport spotted them, shook his head. "Quite a bit of day-old blood. We don't think it was his." "Is someone dead? That much blood?" Lucas asked. Allport relayed the question to somebody out of sight. A cop in a tweed jacket stepped into the hallway and looked down at Lucas and said, "Not that much. I'd say it's got to be maybe a pint." "You find any jewelry? Good stuff?" "Haven't looked yet. Would that be a priority?" "Yeah, it would be." The cop nodded. Allport said, "Give us half an hour." Lucas nodded, "We'll be back." They wasted the half hour at a bagel shop on Grand Avenue, drinking coffee and trying to figure out the next step. They were still shaky from the shooting, talking too fast.
"You know what we should have done?" Marshall said. "When we had that woman over at DDT's place this morning, the one that used to work with Randy, we should have showed her a picture of the guy from the movie."
"God damn it," Lucas said irritably. "I should have thought of that." "I'll get back to her," Dell said. "Maybe I can hook up with some of Randy's other girls, too." Still cranked, they all went back to Randy's. Allport was in the living room with two other cops. "What'd you hear from the hospital?" Dell asked. Allport shook his head. "He's in surgery." The crime scene people found Randy's stash in a hardbound copy of Bullfinch's Mythology, one of a line of what looked like decorator books. The pages of the Bullfinch had been haphazardly glued together, and then a hole cut out of the middle. The hole was just big enough to hold a couple of ounces of grass. It didn't, but it did hold a chamois bag. The cop who found the book shook the bag onto the palm of one hand, and out tumbled two rings, one diamond and one emerald. Lucas, Dell, and Marshall had seen pictures of them.
"Son of a bitch," Dell said.
"Now we know for sure," Lucas said. "He's the link." Back at City Hall, Lucas dropped Marshall with Anderson, the computer guy, and Dell headed back to DDT's. Lucas went back to the office, where Marcy was talking with Lane and Swanson.
"Did you hear about Randy?" she asked.
"What, he died?"
"No, but Allport just called and said the surgeons don't think he's going to have full use of his legs. Not right away, anyway. He'll have to do rehab."
"Oh, shit."
Lucas shook his head.
"Allport told me about the rings. Christ, if Randy hadn't had a gun, we'd have the guy now."
"Did Allport say if he was conscious?"
"Docs have really cut him up. They figure it'll be the day after tomorrow before he makes any sense."
Lucas looked at the three of them.
"What's going on? You got something?"
"Just trying to figure out this Catholic and St. Patrick's business," Lane said. "To tell you the truth, we've got connections running all over the place. We've got so many we don't know what we're doing anymore."
"On the other hand," Marcy said, "I looked at the Minnesota Almanac, and guess what? There's a whole bunch of Catholics among the women who got drawings and the dead ones we've identified, but we don't have a lot more than the percentage of Catholics in the Minnesota population as a whole."
"In other words, the Catholic thing just went up in smoke," Lucas said.
"There's still St. Patrick's," Lane said.
Lucas pulled up a chair. "Where are the names of the people on the faculty? Have you run them past the women who got drawings? We're going to have to do that."
They were still deep into the papers when Marshall came back, with Anderson a few feet behind. They were an odd pair. Harmon Anderson, an aging computer geek, pale as a boiled egg, and Marshall, as weather-beaten and brown as last year's oak leaf.
"Might have something to look at," Marshall said. "Maybe you already thought of it."
"I don't think so," Anderson said. "Terry's smarter than he looks." Marshall grunted, then pushed the paper at Lucas.
"I wanted to know which women named Mrs. Katar as an acquaintance, so Harmon wrote them down for me. He has a chart on his wall that shows when the women got the drawings, and when he wrote down the ones who knew Mrs. Katar, I couldn't help noticing that they were all listed next to each other on the chart. They all got their drawings over a 2-month period, a year and a half ago. They say they don't know each other, but they seem to be connected with Mrs. Qatar. I started to wonder, could they have been at the same place, at the same time, like just before the first drawing came in, some kind of public event? Lucas leaned back in his chair, thinking. I wonder if Helen Qatar's secretary keeps a calendar. Let me check. He stepped into his office, rummaged through his collection of business cards, went back to the main bay, and used Marcy's phone. Qatar's secretary picked up. Wells Museum, Helen Qatar's office. This is Lucas Davenport, the Minneapolis police officer who was there the other day. He explained what he needed. Qatar picked up a moment later.
We're looking. You think this could be significant?
It would explain a lot. We can't figure how you hook into it, but if you were all at the same place, especially if you were one of the main people,
a year and a half ago, in August?
August, early September, couldn't be any later than September 14th. Qatar was gone, then back.
August 29th, we invited 600 people.
These other women who identified you as an acquaintance, would they have been invited? Do you have a guest list?
We wouldn't have a guest list anymore, but we invited everybody on our contacts lists, and I think all four of them are on it. We'll get something for you tomorrow. I never did get a chance to look at that film. Maybe I'll do that tonight.
Anything you can do, we'd appreciate.
Just like Miss Marple.
Weather slept over. Not for the sex, she said, but because she missed him. I think we're settling in, she said before they went to sleep.
When the phone rang, it was still dark. Weather moaned. I'd forgotten about the calls in the middle of the night. 5:30. He found the phone.
Yeah. Chief Davenport?
Speaking.
This is John Davis. I'm a St. Paul patrol sergeant. Lieutenant Allport set out to give you a call.
Lucas sat up.
Yeah, John. What's going on?
I'm with a garbage crew out on East 7th, out at the Camper Indian restaurant. They pulled a body out of the dumpster. We don't have an ID, but she's young, blonde, naked, and she's been strangled with a rope. Allport says to tell you that she fits the profile of all of them women you've been digging up.
Oh, jeez.
Lucas gave the cop Dell's number. He was looking for some other women who work for Randy, and they might have seen this chick, too.
Lucas unplugged the bedroom phone.
The next time he moved, it was after 10 o'clock. He pushed himself up, shaved, showered, and headed downtown. Marshall was talking with Marcy. He saw Lucas and said,
I heard about the girl in the dumpster. What do you think?
Got to call St. Paul. They were going to try to match her blood to the blood at Randy's. Allport had the tests.
She was killed in Whitcomb's apartment. It makes me feel a little better about what happened. The docs don't think he's going to walk again.
Is he going to be able to talk?
Probably not today. He is pretty fucked up.
The killing of the unnamed hooker at Randy Whitcomb's brought a temporary semblance of peace to Qatar's soul. He mentally replayed the scene every few minutes, especially the last part, when she began to quiver.
It's the killing, stupid.
He'd always thought it was the sex, that the killing was punishment for the sexual disappointments. He knew better now. Any sexual practice he'd ever remotely considered, he'd now tried with Barstad. He'd found it boring. It was the killing, and it felt fine. Fine, to have that clarified. He wanted another one. Barstad. They were meeting twice a week, and the sex had gone past strenuous. Today, he thought, things would be different. He had the starter rope in his back pocket and a spade in the back seat of the car. He would bury her so far out in the countryside that she would never be found. If the police wanted to attribute her disappearance to the gravedigger, let him do it. He no longer cared. The power was in him. He even enjoyed his new media appellation, the gravedigger.
All right. He whistled.
She was nude when she met him at the door.
James, I've already started.
I see that.
And I've got a new movie. I pushed the couch back so we could put the futon in front of the TV.
Sex first, he thought. And when he'd been emptied of all the stray emotions that sex seemed to dissolve, he could better appreciate the clear, cool strangulation. She finished, and he did, and they lay side by side, her head on his shoulder.
James, I've been talking to a woman that I've known for several years. She's had some sexual relationships with other women, and we were discussing the possibility of the three of us, if you and she can be friends.
He sat up.
You told her who I am?
Just that you were a professor. She wouldn't have wanted to sleep with a street person or a musician or something.
You told her, God damn it. I told you, I can't be brought into this. I teach at a Catholic school. My whole career, my whole livelihood.
She put a finger out to his lips. She's very discreet. She's married and her husband has no idea.
You fucking moron. You fucking... Hit me, James, in the face, hard. Come on, hit me.
You're nuts. I'm a seeker, James. Hit me.
He slapped her.
Harder, James.
The second time, he'd hit her hard. He'd counted on killing her, but that was now an impossibility.
He was at home that evening, eating a bowl of Fruit Loops, reading the back of the box, when his mother called. She sounded ill.
James, I need to see you.
Something wrong? You sound afflicted.
I am afflicted. Sorely. I need to talk to you immediately.
All right, then. Let me finish my cereal and I'll be over. She rang off and he sat down again. Maybe she really was ill. His mother, he thought. All those years with a good salary. She had a $500,000 in Fidelity. God only knew what in the 401k. $500,000. His mother gone. He put his head in his hands and wept, the tears streaming down his face, his chest heaving. After a minute, he gathered himself. $500,000. A Porsche Boxster S could be had for $50,000. The image of himself in a Boxster, a tan leather jacket. Not suede, he thought. Suede was passé. But something reflective of the suede idea. With light driving gloves of a darker brown, lifting a hand to a small, blonde, admiring co-ed on a street corner. The image was so real that he nearly experienced the reality itself, sitting in his kitchen chair. His mother had said she was afflicted. He hurried out to his car. He parked in the driveway, climbed the stoop at the side door, and rang the doorbell. Helen came to the door.
Come in.
She didn't sound ill. Are you okay?
No.
She led the way back to an L corner where she had her television and sat in her rocker. Qatar trailed along and perched on the couch. She took a remote control, pointed it at the television, and a moment later Qatar found himself looking at an old movie. She paused it. A nice-looking actor was caught full face.
The police have come to see me three times. It has to do with this man who buried all those girls on that hill. They've learned that this man had some training in art, that he spent time at Stout in Wisconsin, that he has some connection with St. Patrick's and myself, that he probably murdered Charlotte Newman.
Qatar had tightened the grip on himself as she began to speak.
And, his mother concluded, they have learned that he looked like this man.
Yes.
James, that is you, 10 years ago. That is you. Mother, you think it's me? My God, this man is a monster. You think it's me? I'm afraid that's what I think, James. I remember all those poor cats with their heads twisted. That was not me. That was Carl Stevenson. I told you then it was Carl.
She looked at him, tears in her eyes.
I want to believe that, but I don't. I hid it even from myself. But I saw you one day, going out in the garage, and I found the cat later.
And suddenly she broke down and began to cry.
That was not me.
Mother, who have you talked to about this?
Nobody. I know the effect this could have on your life. But now I have something to pray over.
My own flesh and blood.
Aw, man. Mother, I don't want to have to deal with this, but I have to say it. I think you're afflicted. You've made this up. I saw the drawings on television. You really think I could draw those things? Come on, Mother.
But it wasn't going to work. He could see it. Well, he knew. He had to act. She was still sitting in the rocker. The actor's face was still frozen on the TV screen, watching them. Helen seemed in despair, but without a touch of fear.
The best thing to do, she began.
She didn't finish. He caught her one-handed by the hair and pulled her straight forward onto the carpet. She went face down, and he dropped on top of her, pinning her with his weight. She grunted desperately,
"James!"
and turned her head, her eyes looking up at him, unbelieving. And he slipped one hand around her face and cupped her mouth in the palm of his hand, and with his thumb and forefinger, pinched her nose. He didn't pinch tightly enough to bruise, only to stop the flow of air. She struggled, but it was all over quickly enough. All right. They were 4 blocks from St. Pat's. She walked, most days, so moving her car would not be a problem. She was always the first one to work, so finding her there would not raise any eyebrows. He would have to change her. He hurried through it, but made sure that she was neat, just as she was in life. He turned off the porch light, stepped outside, scanning the strip of street. When he was sure, he moved her to the back seat of his car. Purse and keys. He got them. Money. She had $50 in her purse. He took 40. And she kept money and squirreled it away. He didn't know where exactly, but he thought the bedroom. And it was in the bedroom, in the closet, under the carpet, in a hole in the floor. He would never have found it if he hadn't been on his hands and knees checking her shoes. A corner of the carpet was pulled up, and when he looked, a wad of cash. He counted once, could not believe the total, and counted again. $8,000? He closed his eyes. $8,000. Everything he wanted, all right here. Back down the stairs. He found a flashlight in a drawer by the sink, turned off all the house lights, and headed out. He drove the 4 blocks to the museum and parked. Got out, then tried her key in the side door. It slipped in easily. He left the door unlocked and walked back out to the car, took a look around, then lifted her out and carried her across the lawn, as though he were humping a rug into the building. Inside, he put her in her chair. Got her cup, in the light of the flash, went down the hall to the men's room, filled it with water, found a pack of instant coffee next to the microwave in the secretary's office, and stirred the coffee into the cup. When it was all ready, he sat her in the chair, put her fingers around the cup handle, and then pushed her onto the floor. She went over, dragging the cup with her. And it really looked good, he thought. There was no trace of violence, just a little old lady who'd gone to sleep, the way she'd have wanted to go. Lucas was talking with Rose Marie Rue the next morning when her secretary poked her head in the door, looked at Lucas and said, "A hysterical woman is on the phone looking for you."
"Switch it in here,"
Rosemarie said. She took the receiver off the hook and handed it across the desk to Lucas.
"Lucas Davenport. Officer Davenport, this is Denise Thompson."
"Denise?"
"Thompson, Helen Katar's secretary. You know she died."
"What? She died? How'd she die?"
"She died at her desk. I don't know. She was at her desk with a cup of coffee, and she must have had a stroke or something."
"Did she call out, or—"
No, I wasn't here. It was before anybody got here this morning. I called 911.
Okay, Mrs. Thompson. Police came?"
"And the ambulance, but it was too late. I could see it was too late."
"Okay.
I don't know why I'm calling you, except that she was joking about being Miss Marple, and now she's gone."
I'll talk to the medical examiner and make sure there was nothing improper. We'll make sure. Are you the contact on that, or...
Her son is, really, if he's not too wrecked. I called him and he ran right over. He went a little nutty. Mr. Davenport, I don't know. I'm not sure I should even bring this up.
Bring up anything you want.
Well, I'm sure it was a stroke or something regular, but she didn't bring her newspaper.
I beg your pardon?
Every day, as long as I've worked here, she would carry her newspaper in.
Every day?
Every day. When she got here, she would put the paper in her in-basket and make a cup of coffee. And then she would answer all of her email. I would come in with my paper, and we would work on her to-do list until break time. And then we would read our newspapers at the same time. But today, she didn't bring her newspaper.
So what are you...
It's just strange, of all days. I'm sure it's nothing, but I wanted to tell somebody.
Thank you. We'll look into it all. When Thompson was gone, he looked at Rosemarie and said, Shit.
It didn't sound good from here.
A little old lady is dead, Helen Cattar, down at St. Pat's. It's possible that she was taken off by the gravedigger. God damn it. She joked about being Miss Marple, and we think the guy may be around there somewhere, and I never told her to be careful.
Try not to get too deep into the guilt.
I won't, but I liked her. One of those active old birds. Smart, still working. God damn it. He ran both hands up through his hair. I just wish, I don't know, we're a lot closer to him than we think, and somehow we dragged her into it.
On his way out of Rosemarie's office, he stopped at the secretary's desk and dialed the number of an investigator at the ME's office.
Yeah, we got her in. I can't tell you much, except that there's no sign of violence, and she was older and was taking some heart drugs.
Could you do everything? There's a chance that somebody took her off. I've been told that she died while she was drinking coffee, so check for poison or weird drugs, anything like that.
I'll tell the doc.
Thanks, let me know.
Sure. Hey, you know, she's got a son, right? He's here now, doing papers.
Hold him, will you? I'm going to run over.
He was going out the door when he saw Anderson and Marshall talking, and when Marshall looked up, said, You here?
It must not be good from the way you sound.
Helen Cattar's dead. She's over at the ME's office, and her son's there. I was just heading over.
I'm coming with.
Marshall turned to Anderson and said, Get you later, Harmon.
When they got to the ME's, Lucas stuck his head into the investigator's office and asked, Where's the son?
He's down talking to the doc, right there, second door.
Cattar's face was pink as a lamb chop. He'd apparently been weeping. The doc was behind his desk, and a remote, smooth-faced blonde perched on a swivel stool. After Lucas knocked, the doc invited them in and said,
Mr. Cattar is having a hard time with this.
I'm sorry, Lucas said. I only met your mother a few days ago, but she seemed like a really nice woman.
She was, Marshall said.
Jiminy Christmas, Cattar said. I knew this could happen any time. She had the heart problem. Yesterday she looked perfectly good, and I never thought.
He started sniffling again, and Lucas jumped in. Did she tell you anything about talking to the police?
Cattar was shaking his head.
No. Everything we talked about, it was just so inconsequential. I still have so many things to say to her. Oh God, I've got to do something about a funeral.
He flapped his arms around.
I've got to get going. I've got...
The blonde hopped off the stool.
I can help for a while.
You're a friend? Lucas asked.
The woman patted Cattar on the shoulder and said, Yes, James and I have been seeing each other.
She looked at Lucas a little too long, a full extra beat, and down in his heart Lucas thought, Huh. Cattar had started leaking again, and the blonde let him out of the room. The door shut behind them, and the doc shook his head.
Guy was losing his shit. I was glad to see you guys.
Was it real or was it bullshit?
Lucas asked.
You think it might be something else?
Nah, not really. He seemed a little overcooked.
On the other hand, do the chemistry.
Want to watch?
No, thanks. A nice clean piece of paper would be fine, Lucas said.
Randy's awake, Dell said. He caught them walking back toward Lucas's office.
You going?
Marshall asked.
Yeah, Dell nodded. I got any company?
Marshall nodded, and Lucas said, I want to come, but let me talk to Marcy first.
Marcy, Black, and Swanson were drinking coffee and looking at paper when he walked in, with Dell and Marshall trailing.
All right, people. We're going to look at nothing but St. Pat's. The guy is over there somewhere.
He told them about Helen Kattar.
Black said, Wasn't her heart. I've got $100 says it wasn't. God damn it, she was a nice old bat.
I'm with you. I think she knew the killer, and somehow tipped him off. All we need is a name. If we get a name, Randy should be able to identify him. I want a name. Randy was in ICU at Regents Hospital in St. Paul. There was a St. Paul cop outside the door who nodded at Lucas and said,
His lawyer's in there.
Who is it?
I don't know. Somebody from the public defenders.
Lucas knocked, stuck his head inside. Randy was lying almost flat. He looked like a deflated version of the Randy they all knew and hated. The lawyer sat next to him, a man Randy's age.
Lucas said to the lawyer, I'm with the Minneapolis police. I need to talk with you.
Later. I'm talking with my client right now.
Do you know how much later?
Whenever I'm done. Wait in the hall.
Better be pretty quick. We don't have a lot of time here.
Hey! When I'm done!
Lucas backed out and Dell said,
Oh boy.
Officious little prick.
Lucas hooked his cell phone out of his pocket and called the Minneapolis dispatcher. Could you get me Harry Page's number over at the Ramsey Public Defender's office?
She came back a minute later with the number and Lucas poked it in.
Page, the number two man in the PD's office, came on the line.
Lucas Davenport. I think you still owe me $3 for that egg salad sandwich I bought you when you were on that panel up at White Bear, Century College. Whatever it was.
Yeah. Christ, you've been whining about it for months.
I need the money. I'm thinking of getting a divorce.
I'll send it tomorrow. I'd hate to see your wife starve.
Listen, I'm over at the hospital, and you've got this officious little prick over here talking to Randy Whitcomb.
Whitcomb is the guy the cop shot?
Yeah. And we found blood all over his apartment, which he was trying to clean up with paper towels when we broke in. Then the St. Paul cops found the body of his girlfriend in a dumpster, and her blood matches the blood in his apartment, so he's in a shitload of trouble. But we might be able to get him off the murder charge if he gives us a little help.
How?
The killing looks a lot like the killings done by this gravedigger guy, and we know that Randy sold some jewelry that came off one of the victims. If we can get an ID from Randy, we think the murder charge will go away, but your officious little prick won't even let us in the door.
Which officious little prick did we send over there?
Real young, black suit, looks like it was run over by a tractor.
The little prick's name is Robert, call me Rob, Lansing, like in Michigan.
You say you're in the hallway?
Yeah.
Stand right there, he'll come talk to you.
Lucas hung up, and 10 seconds later they heard a cell phone ring inside the room. A minute after that, Lansing popped out in the hallway.
Which one of you assholes called Paige?
I did, you officious little prick. You want to talk about the welfare of your client or you want to play status games?
The legal matters took 5 minutes to straighten out. When they went into the room, Randy's eyes drifted over the four of them. They stopped at Lucas.
You fucking asshole,
he said.
Yeah, blow me. Randy, you're in a shitload of trouble, but God help me, I'm here to try to get you out of some of it. Do you know the man who killed your girlfriend? Killed Suzanne?
Not me.
Who did?
Some fucking asshole.
You got a name?
Randy shook his head.
Can't remember. Head's all fucked up.
Look at this picture. Lucas showed him the artist sketch of the actor from Day of the Jackal. Is this the dude?
No, man. I don't know the dude.
You don't know him?
He doesn't know him,
Lansing snapped.
Dell said, you want him to know the guy. You got the concept here?
Hey, listen, you, shut up,
Marshall said to Lansing.
And to Randy, a first name, a last name, somebody else who knows him, anything.
I gots to think, I'm all fucked up.
They came at the question 9 different ways, but Randy shook his head and finally dozed off.
Maybe tomorrow, Dell said. He's still got a lot of shit in him.
Marcy was the only person in the office when they got back. We got everybody down at St. Patrick's, she said. We got some chemistry back from the ME's office. They think maybe she was smothered.
I knew it, Lucas said. It had to be somebody who knew her well enough to get her back to her office.
What was her kid's name? James?
Yeah. Doesn't fit the picture, but the picture could be crap,
Marshall said.
He doesn't look like the right movie star. He looks more like Yul Brynner.
What happened with Randy? Marcy asked.
Lucas told her the story.
Gotta get back to him, Marcy said. He's still got the key.
I know, I know. God damn it. Looked like it was gonna be easy. Instead, it's like counting votes in Florida.
The rest of the afternoon was tedious. They all went looking for professors, talking with students, pushing to find friends of Helen Kattar. At the end of the day, they'd struck out. Just before they quit, Lucas said to Dell, you and Cheryl are coming for lobsters tonight, right?
Hell yes. Gotta keep this mass murder shit in proportion.
I had no idea that you could show this depth of emotion, even about the death of a parent, Barstad said as they left the ME's office. It's a side of you that I haven't seen before, James. I'm encouraged and
blah, 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 Kattar thought, tuning her out.
There were still tears in his eyes, but they were quickly drying.
His mother.
There had been some good times. Learning to ride a bicycle. The first drawing materials she bought for him. And some bad times. He could remember Howard Cord, a history professor who would come over late in the evening and bang his mother's brains loose. She must have known that he could hear it all, in his bedroom right above hers. Must have suspected that he'd lifted a floorboard and cut a hole in a heating vent so he could watch. Watch her doing all that. And not just Howard Cord. There had been 10 or 15 men from the time his father left. But he really couldn't blame his mother's galloping sexuality for his problems. They went much further back. He remembered still the intense pleasure of burning ants with a magnifying glass when he was not yet in grade school. He'd already known enough to hide himself and his impulses. His personal craziness had been there all along. The cross he must bear. Bear it he did. His mother was not to blame.
Blah, 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 she asked.
He hadn't heard any of it. He had, in fact, brought her along as a prop. His woman, should any of the cops think there might be something odd about him. They had been all over campus.
What?
What now? There's not much to do until you know when she'll be released, Barstad said.
I haven't eaten. I don't know if I could eat, maybe a little something.
They walked to the Pillsbury building, went up the escalator, and through the warren of shops in the Skyway.
It's really like a Middle Eastern bazaar, Barstad said.
They were in the back of a coffee shop, eating baklava and drinking strong coffee.
Let's walk some more, he said.
He had the money in his pocket from his mother's house, and Sachs and Neiman Marcus were right around the corner. On the way to the mall, he stopped and looked in the window of a jewelry store, where they were featuring small men's rings set with star sapphires. He'd never considered a ring, but they had a certain look.
In here, he said, just on a lark.
He paid $2,000 for a gold ring that perfectly fit his right pinky.
My mother's favorite color was blue, he told her.
He teared up again, wiped them away, and they mushed on to Saks. There they found the most marvelous thigh-length leather jacket, smooth finished with kangaroo hide details. On sale, $1,120. He looked at it and said,
Oh my God, 40 long.
Her eyes were on him, and he said, reverently, It's exactly my size.
Oh my God, she said.
Weather said it was no big deal, just friends getting together for beer and a little seafood, but she got to Lucas's place early and spent 3 hours dusting and vacuuming. She was also wearing the engagement ring. Sloane had traded his usual brown for khakis and a brown sweater. Dell did his best to look neat, in jeans that had been ironed. Their wives looked like cops' wives, carefully dressed in sweaters and slacks, a little too chunky, with skeptical eyes. They talked about cases, but not the gravedigger case. They talked about medicine, but not Randy. And finally Cheryl, Dell's wife, watching her husband crack a lobster claw and dip it in butter, asked, I wonder if lobster has as much cholesterol as shrimp. Cheryl looked at the other two women. Is Dell the only one with high cholesterol?
Aw, shut up, Dell said. No, really.
Sloane's is so low that it's like a race with his blood pressure to see which one can hit bottom first. I'm sort of borderline, Sloane's wife said. I'm okay. Lucas has to think about it, but he's basically okay if he just cut out the donuts, Weather said. Dell's ought to be better with this lap of orange stuff. Mr. Sophisticated has been worrying about what that guy told you in the bar, Cheryl said to Lucas. Lucas had to think a minute. The Cobra. Oh, yeah. Lapivorin makes you come backwards.
What?
Sloane was interested.
Ah, oh, Jesus, Dell said.
This guy told us that this woman who got killed by the gravedigger, that the only thing that she said about him was that he was taking Lapivorin and was afraid that he was going to be screwed up sexually. Some kind of ejaculation thing happens and... He hesitated to say it, but Dell didn't.
You come backwards. Nothing comes out.
They were all mildly amused, and Weather said, Dell, that's nonsense. I know a little about Lapivorin, and there are no side effects like that at all. You've got to have your liver function checked every once in a while, a blood test.
Really?
He said, brightening. You mean the guy was talking through his ass? Lucas asked. I was planning to pimp Dell with this for the next 10 years. Not Lapivorin. What he was talking about is a situation you see in a certain percentage of men who use that baldness drug.
What's that?
Dell asked. The stuff to make your hair grow. It's got enough weird hormones in it that they recommend that women never handle it. With all the talk, nothing tripped with Lucas until the next morning. Weather had already gone and he was in the shower. He thought of aging, and the whole group getting gray, and that they were worrying about cholesterol and reverse ejaculation. When it struck him.
Son of a bitch.
Weather said it was the baldness remedy that made you come backwards. So the guy was bald. Or getting that way. He didn't look like the jackal actor. That guy was all teeth and eyes and hair. Take away the hair. He'd just met a young bald guy from St. Patrick's who was close to Helen Cattar and who... Was he remembering this right? Mrs. Cattar had said was in the same department as the Newman woman. He closed his eyes and pictured Cattar with hair. Holy shit. Could be a coincidence. Didn't feel that way. Fucking James Cattar. He saw James Cattar's girlfriend. Young, blonde, fairly small, arty looking. She could have been a model for the woman who'd been murdered. Fucking Cattar. Marcy was immersed in a pile of paper. Dell hadn't made it in yet, and Marshall was drinking coffee and reading a copy of Cosmopolitan. Marcy looked up. Hey, Black and Swanson are getting nowhere, but the FBI just came in with a revised sexual profile and... Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. She stood up. She knew the tone. Why doesn't it matter? Marshall had stopped reading as Lucas continued to his office. Because when I was in the shower this morning, I was soaping up my hard washboard abs at the time. Marcy was following along behind him. Before washing your socks on them. when I realized that the gravedigger is none other than James Cattar, Helen Cattar's son. He looked at Marshall. You know anybody at Stout?
Yeah, a few people. I know the president.
Call somebody who might know. Ask him if they show a James Cattar as a student when Laura disappeared. Marshall dug a card case out of his jacket pocket, pulled out a stack of cards, shuffled through them, then picked up the phone. A few minutes later, he hung up.
You ought to take more showers. Cattar was there.
Lucas told Marcy, get everybody back here, and don't let any of this leak to the goddamn interdisciplinary group, or whatever it's called. I don't want a bunch of feds running all over the place. Let's keep it quiet, but point everybody at Cattar.
Right. They told me that sometimes you do this kind of shit, Marshall said. I believe you, but basically it's all bullshit held together with baling wire.
Lucas said, I wonder if that chick he was with knows him very well. I wonder if she signed in yesterday when they were at the ME's office. I think if you're going to officially look at a body, you wind up signing something, don't you? Maybe we ought to look her up. While Marcy was calling in Black, Lane, and Swanson, Lucas got on the phone to Dell and called him at breakfast. I need the name of the woman you talked to, the one whose pictures were posted on the bridge.
Beverly Wood. But I talked to her and there's not much there.
You got a number?
Yeah. Did something come up?
I solved the case this morning. Maybe talking to her again will give us another confirmation.
Jeez. That's good. Here's the number.
He read it off.
You didn't really solve the case, did you?
Tell you about it when you get here.
Give me a hint.
I ejaculated backwards. He called Beverly Wood, was told that she was in a classroom. There was no phone in the classroom, but he was no more than 10 minutes away. Beverly Wood's class involved 8 people. Lucas stuck his head in.
Beverly Wood?
Yes. I'm with the Minneapolis police. I need to talk with you somewhat urgently. She looked at her class. Nothing scandalous, I can assure you. I'll be back in a minute. He got her out in the hall and said, You've talked to Officer Capslock a couple of times about the drawings, but let me ask you, have you heard of a man named James Cattar?
You've got to be kidding.
You know him?
Not exactly. He published a ridiculous paper. I'm afraid I ridiculed it.
You ridiculed him personally?
Everything's personal when you're talking about scholarship.
But he would have felt ridiculed personally?
I certainly hope so.
He's the one who did the drawings?
We don't know. His name came up and we were wondering if you might have had some contact.
Just that article. I've never laid eyes on the man as far as I know. How long between the time you published the article and when the drawings were posted on the bridge?
Let me see. 4 months?
I would have told Officer Capslock, but to tell you the truth, the whole thing was so trivial to me, the review, I mean, that I'd completely forgotten it. What if the shoe were on the other foot, and you'd written an article, and it was criticized in the same way? Would you have remembered the criticism?
Oh, yes. Probably forever. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I had a pretty good time with him.
Thank you. Please don't tell anybody about this talk. We don't know who this man is for sure.
The gravedigger?
If he is, we figure it's best not to attract his attention. Dell was waiting when he got back, and he took 2 minutes to explain it. Marshall added, We got a fax from Stout. He was there for 2 years, and then went to Madison the year after Laura disappeared. He majored in art at Stout, and from Madison, they tell me that he was in art history.
So he's got to be able to draw, Lucas said.
I wonder what he was doing with that pimp.
We can ask Randy, Lucas said. To Marcy, we need to get somebody to track him down, Cattar, and take a picture of him without him knowing it.
Lane can do that. He's a good photographer.
When they were all assembled, Lucas laid out what they had. Cattar had been at Stout when Laura Winton disappeared. He'd grown up near St. Pat's, where his father had been a professor and his mother an administrative employee and later head of the Wells Museum. He fit the image of the man described by Winton, or at least he would if he had hair.
He had art training. His office was just down the hall from Newman. His mother died shortly after saying that she'd snoop around a bit. And his current girlfriend was the spitting image of all the women who'd been killed. Her name is Ellen Barstad, Marcy said. We know he steals valuables from his victims. They're not souvenirs, though. He's apparently doing it for the money. Once we get in his house, we've got to look at everything with a microscope. If we could find one thing that comes from the victims, that would be enormous. We got to get in and grab his computers, Lane said. If Marcy's artist friend is right, and he's drawing from computer photos, then maybe they'll have everything we need.
Good. Lucas made a note on his legal pad. Why weren't we onto him sooner, with all the time we put in at St. Pat's?
Black said, because we were looking for people connected with art. In the art department, that's hundreds of people. Katara Newman were in the history department. He shrugged. We never looked in history.
I see two keys. We need Randy to identify him as the guy who sold him the jewelry, and maybe, we can do something with his girlfriend.
I can get a headshot, Lane said. It might take me a day or two if we don't want him to spot me.
Push it hard. I'd love to get something today so we can get it over to Randy.
How about the girlfriend? Del asked. That's you and me.
Marshall said.
And me.
Lucas nodded and turned to Swanson and Black. You two, I want you back at St. Pat's. I need something that could put him with the other dead women that we've identified.
Are we going to track him? Marcy asked.
I'll get some guys from intelligence, maybe just one guy at a time, keeping a light tag. No reason to think he's going to run.
Marcy asked, what about me?
Go talk to the county attorney. Tell him what we've got and find out what we need, how bad we're hurting.
I think we're hurting a little. Like Terry said, we've connected a lot of dots, but nothing really critical.
Except Randy, who we managed to cripple.
Yeah, that little prick.
Before they went looking for Ellen Barstad, Lucas stopped at Rosemarie's office to tell her what they were doing. He gave her a quick summary.
New topic, she said. If you had a chance to take a job with the state, would you take it?
He shrugged. I sort of like it here.
But if you couldn't stay here?
What are you working on?
She leaned across the desk.
The guy running the Department of Public Safety? The governor doesn't like him. He does like me.
So you're thinking of moving up?
The possibilities out there.
Well, he rubbed his forehead with his fingertips. That's a different kind of work.
Not for you, it wouldn't be. You'd be doing the same thing you do here. Working on your own, big cases, intelligence. Figuring things out. Maybe some political work. You could bring along Dell if you wanted. Think about it. I don't know if the whole thing is going to work out anyway. A couple of things have got to fall just right.
But the governor likes you.
He does. What's even more important, he's going to be reelected if he doesn't fuck up the tax thing. So we'd have at least 7 more years. We'd be like Hawaii 5-0.
Jesus. Hawaii 5-0. All right. I'll think about it.
Keep in touch on this Qatar thing. It wouldn't hurt our image if we nailed this down. Politically, it's just the right time.
He picked up Dell, and they went looking for Barstad. They had an address and phone number. The address turned out to be in another one of the faceless business parks, nearly identical to the one where Ware had his porn studio.
I thought it was her home address, Dell said, as they pulled into the parking area.
The door was heavily silvered glass, and the sign was in gold stick-on letters. Barstad Crafts. The door was locked, but they could see a light in the back. Lucas knocked, and a woman stepped into the light, then started toward them. When she got close, Lucas took out his ID case and held it up so she could see it. She turned the lock and said,
"Yes?"
Lucas recognized her from the ME's office. "Ellen Barstad?"
"Yes."
Lucas introduced himself and Dell and said, "We have a serious problem, and we need to talk to you about it. Would you have a few minutes?"
Well,
she looked carefully at Dell. You're the man who was at the medical examiner's office.
Yeah.
Okay. Come in. Let me lock the door behind you.
The front of the store was an open bay with quilt frames. All held quilts in various stages of completion. "I give classes," she said.
"This is a really nice quilt," Dell said, and he meant it.
The quilt was a traditional log cabin style, but the colors had been carefully chosen and placed, so that light seemed to be falling across the quilt from one side to the other. It was almost as if the quilt were spread across a bed by a sunlit window. Barstad picked up on his sincerity and asked, "Do you have quilts?"
"Two of them. My sister-in-law makes them. Nothing like this, though."
They spent a moment looking at the quilt, bonding. Then Barstad said, "What can I do for you? Why don't you come in back? I can make some coffee, if you don't mind microwave." The back part of the commercial space had been carefully divided into small rooms. Lucas could see one end of a bed in a side room, and a toilet and sink in a corner between the bedroom and the living room space. A kitchen had been carved out of another corner. Altogether, he thought, it looked snug, artsy-craftsy, and even a little snazzy. As she got cups, Lucas said, "You were at the ME's office with James Cattar."
"Yes. James and I have been dating.
Do you think he killed his mother?"
Where did that question come from?
"I don't know. His mother's dead and the cops show up and ask questions.
Was she murdered?"
"We think she may have been."
"Was there anything in particular that caused you to ask the question?"
"Yes. James is a would-be clothes horse. He loves to get dressed up. It's like when he tries to picture himself, the main thing he sees are clothes. But he never has enough money to get the really good ones."
The microwave beeped, and she took the three cups out and passed them around.
"Anyway, he called me after his mother was found, said he needed moral support to look at her body. So I went with him, and he was all weepy when you showed up. I felt like I was a prop. But I'll tell you, the weeping stopped 1 minute after we left, and we went on a shopping spree. For him. He paid $2,000 for a pinky ring, for God's sake. Probably $3,000 more in Saks and Neiman's. And he just doesn't have that kind of money. I think it came from his mother's house."
Dell said, "Look, we don't want you to betray a friendship."
"Of course you do. What do you want me to do?"
Lucas cocked his head. "I get the impression that you're not all that friendly.
We've been sleeping together for 3 weeks, but it's just about to end. I knew he might have been a little freaky. He had that shine in his eyes. But I had some things I wanted from him, too, so that was okay. And he's clean. But after that deal with his mom, he sort of scared me. How about if I asked him about killing people? Don't you guys bug apartments? I could get him here and ask him."
"That might be a little crude, just coming out and asking," Dell said. "Especially if it pissed him off and he picked up a steam iron and popped you on the head with it. We could get in quick, but not that quick.
But I'm not stupid. If he looked like he was getting ready to do something, I'd scream my head off. He doesn't carry a gun. He doesn't even carry a pocket knife."
"You seem pretty willing to get into this," Lucas observed.
"Hey, it's interesting. You think he might have killed his mom? I'm willing to help out."
"There's more to it than that," Dell said. "If you've seen the TV stories on this guy they call the Grave Digger..."
She straightened. "You're kidding me."
"Oh, man."
"A violent guy. If he's the right guy," Lucas said.
"Well, let's get him."
Lucas nodded. "We appreciate this."
"Those women the gravedigger killed, they said he likes a type."
She looked down at herself.
Dell said, "Yep, you're the type."
"Exactly." Lucas suggested that until they could work the trap, that Barstad stay out of her apartment and out of touch with Cattar. "Maybe call him right now and tell him you have to go somewhere, Chicago, to see about a quilt show. Tell him you'll be back tomorrow." She agreed, called Cattar's house, and left the message.
"Listen, I really, really need to get together tomorrow, though. Could you come over after your 1 o'clock class? Then maybe we can go wine shopping. I got out some more money. Might as well do it right."
She hung up. That was fine.
Now get some clothes together. We'll take you with us and find you a place to stay. I work at a bookstore in the evenings. Could you call them and fix things?
Yeah, we can take care of it.
She took 10 minutes to pack, and they left together. On the way back, Lucas called Marcy, who set up a room in the Radisson Hotel. They checked her in, warned her about going out, and left her.
That's the goddamn ditziest woman I've met since forever, Dell said on his way out of the hotel. What are the chances that she's going to stay in that room?
She says Qatar doesn't like to go out, so she ought to be okay.
I hope.
When they got back to the office, Lucas asked Marcy, "Hear anything from Lane?"
He said Qatar's got a class. He'll try to get him at the school.
Towson called. He wants to talk to you. Randall Towson was the county attorney. I told him everything. He's a little worried about going with an identification by Randy. Randy's pretty impeachable, he says.
Sure, but we've got the hard evidence. We found the earrings in his apartment.
Call him, Marcy said.
I will, but I need you to check out a surveillance deal.
He told her about Barstad in her apartment.
All right, I'll get on it. I better talk to her first, find some place we can do the monitoring from.
Lucas looked around.
Where's Marshall?
He went home. He had some stuff to do.
Okay.
And I'll call Towson.
Randy Towson wasn't a bad county attorney. Still, he had his own priorities, like re-election. He did not enjoy losing court cases that were heavily covered by the movie people. With evidence, he always wanted more.
Look, he said, Marcy laid it out pretty well, and I appreciate the circumstantial stuff. But at this point, if you don't get Whitcomb, you don't get Qatar. And Whitcomb is not reliable. When he figures out that he could be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, he might be pretty unhappy with our side. And what's Qatar ever done to him?
I know. We're working on one more thing.
Lucas described the relationship between Barstad and Qatar. We're going to wire her apartment.
Good. The more the better. If we can get him on tape and Whitcomb comes through, he's toast. Once we get him and we get into his house, get at his computer and all his other stuff, there's a chance we'll find more.
That's what I was thinking, Lucas said.
Because there'd be one thing worse than losing the trial, and that's having him kill somebody else while we're jacking around.
Especially if the TV people found out about it.
That's what I was thinking, said Towson.
Marcy moved quickly on the surveillance. We've got Jim Gibson free. He's going to go up to the Radisson to get Barstad's keys, and then he's going to go over and look at her apartment. Barstad said there's a place next door called Culver Processing Sales that's a good possibility as a place that we can hide out. I just talked to the owner. It's a Dave Culver, and he says he wants to talk to the guy in charge, you, before he says yes. I'll run back up there.
At Barstad's, he saw Gibson standing in the parking lot behind his van. When he swung past a park, he saw Barstad using her keys to open the door.
God damn it! What was she doing here?
She told me she was supposed to come along, Gibson said, when Lucas got out and asked him.
Is that wrong?
It would be if Qatar swung by for an afternooner.
Inside, Barstad said, I needed to come back. I forgot some stuff.
We need to keep you out of sight.
James is teaching. He'd never come all the way here without calling, so... She shrugged.
Come on, I'll introduce you to Dave Culver. He's a nice guy.
What does he do?
Sells big meat cutters and grinders and so on to restaurants.
Culver was a heavyset man in his late 50s with a Stalinite mustache. He was in the back of his business when they pushed through the front door. Barstad shouted,
Hey Dave, it's me and the cops.
They were standing in a small reception room with 3 easy chairs and a coffee table. Culver came out of the back and said, Hey sweetie, to Barstad.
Lucas shook and introduced himself and outlined what they hoped to do.
Is Miss Crazy Quilt going to get her ass in trouble? Culver asked.
That's why we need to be close. We don't think you'll pull anything, but just in case.
All right. My only other problem is I don't want to be dealing with some gang that's going to be coming by afterwards and tear up the place. I got $250,000 worth of new equipment in the back.
It's one guy. He's not connected to anyone. If we take him off, he won't be out of Stillwater for 30 years minimum. Culver nodded. So use the place. You got any friends in the restaurant business? Give him my card. When they were done, and the equipment had tested out, Lucas looked at his watch and said, We're all done for the day. Jim, if you'd drop Ellen off at the hotel on the way back, I'd appreciate it. We all got to be back here in place at noon tomorrow. Lane called later about Qatar.
I miss the son of a bitch. There are just too many doors here, and I don't know where the hell he's gotten to. He's not home. I'll get her early tomorrow. I'll get him tomorrow for sure.
Soon as you can, man.
I know.
Marcy called Lucas at 8:30 and caught him still in bed. The docs had a talk with Randy late yesterday afternoon. They told him he might not walk again. He freaked out. I called over there today to this Robert Lansing guy to set up a rush-rush deal to get the photos over there when Lane gets them. And Lansing says it's all off for now. He says Randy won't talk to anyone. And he won't even talk to Lansing. He screams at everybody who comes in the room.
Jesus.
Well, you know, if it was one of us.
Yeah.
If it was him, Lucas thought, he might sooner or later stick a gun in his mouth. Qatar was sitting at his desk, trying to get through a deck of photographic slides he used in lecture. He didn't like to use more than 20 per class. They couldn't be absorbed. When all was said and done, he was a decent teacher. Beyond that, as a buzz in the back of his mind, lingered the fear created by the growing media spectacle of the gravedigger. This was humming in the background of his slide sort when the phone rang. He picked it up, thinking, Ellen. And it was.
I'm back.
She seemed uncharacteristically breathless.
Did you get my message?
Yes. This afternoon would be fine. How much do you have for the wine?
1,000? I sold a huge star quilt, the rippling light. I thought with 1,000, I could get a really good start.
A fine start.
Listen, I don't want to give anything away, but have you ever heard of sexual asphyxiation?
What?
I saw it in some art film. A guy hanged himself, not completely, but enough to choke off the air, and when the police asked him about it, he said, You have the most wonderful orgasms.
Well, I've heard of it, but I think it might be dangerous. We don't want to go too far.
Okay, but James, think about it.
He couldn't stop thinking about it, and developed an erection so intense that it was almost painful. One of the young virgins in his Matrix of Romanticism class was nearly perfect. Blank, clueless blue eyes, fine slender body, punky blonde hair. She would be perfect. He thought of sexual asphyxiation and tried to talk about Jericho's The Raft of the Medusa, and also kept his sports jacket appropriately draped as the erection came and went. He could imagine this blank-eyed blonde on a bed, the long groove of her spinal column leading up her back to her neck, her head arches in orgasm, and the rope in his hand. By the time he left for Ellen Barstad's studio, he was in a hurry, his worries about the gravedigger investigation pushed to the back of his mind. He needed to see her now. In his hip pocket, he carried his rope.